Yesterday, Sunday, July 24th, Front Page turned 24 years old. Our very first show was on July 24th, 1992. This hour, we go back to that first show and a number of other shows in days gone by as we wind toward an end of Front Page on August 31st, at least with yours truly as a host and co-host here on WWIB and WIB.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's get right after it. Front Page made possible in part thanks to you and your generous tax-deductible support of Western Wisconsin's Inspirational Broadcaster Incorporated. There's been a lot in the news in recent days about violence against police. 5 dead officers in Dallas, 3 dead in Baton Rouge, and a lot more that's been controversial. But we go back to our very first Front Page show, and in fact, a controversial song, Cop Killer, started us off.
Good afternoon, and welcome to WWIV's Front Page. We're going to open the program today with an excerpt, a edited excerpt, I should say, of the controversial song, Cop Killer. This is from Ice-T.
Cop Killer!
Again, that was obviously an edited version as best we could of the highly controversial Cop Killer song by rapper Ice-T, though in fact it's not a true rapper album, this Body Count album that he's come out with. It is a strongly violent album, and specifically that song. There are others, however, like Mama's Gotta Die Tonight. Maybe you couldn't understand the words. Let me help you with some of them, those that at least are arable on the public airwaves here in the United States. It starts off, I got my black shirt on, I got my black gloves on, I got my ski mask on, this bend's too long, skipped a word there, I got my 12-gauge sawed off, I got my headlights turned off, I'm about to bust some shots off, I'm about to dust some cops off. Cop killer, it's better you than me, cop killer, police brutality, cop killer, I know your family's grieving, cop killer, but tonight we get even. All right, that just gives you some idea of why this song is so controversial. Tonight, Ice-T is doing a concert in Los Angeles. And joining us by phone from the other end of the country, New York City, is Jim Corey. Jim is a spokesperson for the National Association of Chiefs of Police. And Jim, this Ice-T song has really received a unified opposition from police unions across the country.
I think deservedly so. I think it is disgraceful that this type of for want of a better word, trash is out there and being defended by a company like Time Warner under First Amendment privilege or rights it leaves me speechless. This is actually, believe it or not, the first time I heard it. I'd never heard the music, basically because it cannot be played on the air, and it loses something when you start bleeping out the words. It is just a degrading, rock tune, and we find it disgraceful. We really do, and we're very distressed by the message that's being sent out there, especially to inner-city young people. This is not the time to send that message out. We need a time of healing. We don't need more division.
Long before Front Page was a daily show, we started off just every other week and then became a weekly, twice a week, three times a week. And as we were building recognition in the Chippewa Valley, we came on the map in the political realm on March 5th, 1993, with a on-air debate between a couple of area state Senate candidates.
With Democratic State Senator Marv Rochelle having taken a job in the Thompson administration, his seat in the 23rd State Senate District is up for grabs. Those vying for it include State Representative Dave Zien, a Republican, and Chippewa County Clerk Jerry Dockle, a Democrat. 2 weeks ago today, Zien showed up at Dockle's headquarters in Chippewa Falls, wanting Dockle to sign a clean campaign pledge. Dockle refused.
You're weak on issues. You must try to get the sympathy vote. And you've been awful weak on issues.
Weak on issues?
Yes, you have.
I'm not for a sales tax increase. You are. I don't want tax increases at all. You do. I want spending limits. I don't know where you stand on spending limits. I don't know where you stand on medical care. You know my record. I do not know your record. You want to come campaign with me someday? I'll show you what the issues of the people. I address the issues of the people. Lock, stock, and barrel.
So if I've been out there, I've been out knocking on doors too.
Zien and Dockle are in our WWIB studios to talk about the issues and to field your calls. And we'll have it all next on Front Page.
More media descended upon our WWIB studio for the Zien-Dockle showdown than any other time in the history of the 24-year run of the show.
Good afternoon and welcome to Front Page on WWIB, 7 minutes after 1 o'clock. And we welcome to our studios State Representative Dave Zien from the 68th Assembly District, and also Chippewa County Clerk Jerry Dockle. Afternoon, gentlemen.
Good to be here, Mark.
All right, good to have you both along. Also, we welcome some other media that are here from the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, WEAU Television, and Update, the news service at UW-Eau Claire, and others that are watching from our hallways and places this afternoon.
Later in June of 93, we took Front Page on the road for the National Right to Life Convention in Milwaukee.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Hyatt Regency in downtown Milwaukee, where we're just moments away from Bill Bennett. I'm sure he's going to talk a lot about Bill Clinton, though, in this edition of today's Front Page. Good to have you along today on WWIB and tell you a little bit about what you can expect today. We are going to be carrying the majority, if not the entirety, of Mr. Bennett's speech. He is the highlight of this second day of the 21st Annual National Right to Life Convention. Yesterday, the convention attendees, which include about 1,500 pro-lifers from across the country, every state represented, in fact, heard from Richard John Newhouse. He has written on the subject of church and state separation and how, in fact, the church needs to be a part of government and the public policy issues of the day. And yesterday, he addressed the convention. Tomorrow, Fred Barnes, the senior editor with the New Republic magazine, which is by and large recognized as a pro-democratic, liberal magazine, but he is a conservative element thereof, and he is going to address the convention tomorrow. But Mr. Bennett, the highlighted speaker today. Mr. Bennett is currently the co-director of Empower America, a nonprofit organization he co-founded with Jack Kemp, Gene Kirkpatrick, and Vin Weber. And this morning, he addressed about 700 people were attending the first regional conference of Empower America here in Milwaukee at the Italian Community Center. At that time, Mr. Bennett making a brief remark that he is pro-life and said that he doesn't care if you're pro-life or pro-choice. Nobody can be happy about the 1.7 million abortions that are occurring in this country every year.
Sticking with the issue of abortion and sanctity of life, we can go back 20 years. There was also a Republican convention going on August 15th, 1996, as we talked with former Pennsylvania Governor Pro-lifer Robert Casey.
One of the threads of your book, and that is, your book is titled Fighting for Life, the story of a courageous pro-life Democrat whose own brush with death made medical history. So there's a couple of different themes. It's a story of your life in some senses, your life as the governor of Pennsylvania, but your pro-life views. And let me ask you this, because this has been you acknowledged it's been almost flawless in terms of the presentation the Republicans have made, but some criticism coming today from Alan Keyes, who was one of the Republican candidates for president, an African-American who had a strong pro-family, anti-abortion theme in his candidacy. And he's been critical, saying that those who hold strongly to the pro-life view, with just a couple of exceptions, have not been allowed to speak. And there have been some traditions that have been broken here. Certainly, you know, the speeches are basically controlled. And it's our own governor was on the platform for 9 minutes the other night. Or you've got these people who just get a short time. It's not like traditionally. It's certainly not like 4 years ago in Houston, where a Pat Buchanan was allowed to be himself, so to speak. What about that?
Well, I think it's a sign of the times. I think it's a response to the intimidation that drips from the networks and the major papers on this issue. I think, frankly, the Republicans have been intimidated by that. You know, it's inconceivable to me that an issue as important as life will get virtually no mention at either convention. In other words, while on the one hand they will tell you, well, we're going to let so-and-so speak who is pro-life, or we're going to let so-and-so speak who happens to be pro-choice. But when those people get up there, you notice, whether it's Colin Powell or whether it's the congresswoman who gave the keynote speech, Congresswoman Molinari, the issue itself is never talked about. Okay? I defy anyone to, with the exception of that, and by the way, speaking of the convention, that Steve McDonald, did you see the convention last night?
I saw up with Elizabeth Dole, yeah.
The police officer from New York?
No.
Absolutely eloquent. He's a paraplegic. He appeared in a wheelchair and he spoke most eloquently. But he did make a plea for the pro-life, for life.
Mm-hmm.
But there apparently will be no mention of that, of the substance of the issue, what it's doing to the country, why it's central to the future of the country, why it's the most important and overriding civil rights and human rights issue of our time. To think that the two major parties can come together in convention and that issue is never even mentioned.
Well, people will sometimes ask me, who's been your favorite guest on Front Page over the more than 20 years you've done the show? I quickly answer Dr. Larry Crabb, but right up there near the top was his former ministry partner, Dr. Dan Allender. Back on October 13th, 1994, we talked to Allender about his book, Cry of the Soul.
The Cry of the Soul, if I can just start with two real simple premises. The first is that as I talk with people on a regular basis, what I've noted is very few people think of their emotions as really reflecting something of what their heart is saying and doing with God. We think very horizontally. That is, someone's nice to me and I feel good. Someone's mean to me, I feel bad or angry. And that's true. I mean, certainly most of our emotions are provoked on a very day-to-day, event-oriented manner. But the book that The Cry of the Soul attempts to say that there's a whole lot more going on. Yes, it's provoked horizontally, but it's also a reflection of something that we say and do about our with our heart before God. That's one premise of the book. The second premise is that if we want to know our heart and know the truly the cry of our soul, the place we look to ultimately would be the Scriptures. We want to know our heart. We need to know the Scriptures. But in terms of the Scriptures, there's probably no section of the Scriptures better revelatory of what's going on in our heart than the Psalms. John Calvin used to put it this way, that the Psalms are a mirror of the soul. And therefore, if we want to know what's going on, we want to look in our own face to see what's there, we need to look into the Psalms.
The listeners to WWIB that listen to me with any degree of regularity on our morning show, Daybreak or Front Page, whatever, know that I'm a big Larry Crabb fan, have mentioned that he's probably my favorite Christian author. But, you know, I've found that as I've looked at some of what you've written in Bold Love and now The Cry of the Soul and what Dr. Crabb has written, it seems almost interchangeable when it's referred to that your ministry partners. I mean, your thinking is very similar, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I think we both begin with a very simple framework, and that is that the great heresy of our day is that there's some way to get heaven now, a way of getting a portion of heaven now. Our hearts are called to wait in anticipation of the day that will dawn, but not hopelessly. We have the opportunity to be aware of something of what's going on in our heart in terms of both our dignity, that is what I was meant to be, and a clenched-fisted, what we'll call the old word, depravity, that basically says I'm committed to making my life work. And as I understand both parts of me, what I was meant to be and what I often am, then there's something of God's work within me that propels me toward even more Christ-likeness. So I think there are some awfully profound similarities in terms of what we both want to accomplish.
And that ties in. Maybe the book that he's best known for even now is Inside Out, How Real Change is Possible. When you begin from the inside out, and I think as we look at what you wrote in Bold Love and even in this book, that we've got to do that. And yet it's such a frightening thing. And you refer to the heart, and we think of Jeremiah 17 that says, the heart is wicked and deceitful and beyond cure. Who can understand it?
It is.
We just kind of want to, we want to decorate the outside, make it look as good as we can, because we don't understand how bad we really are.
Well, I think there is a degree to which once we finally say, life will never be heaven, and in fact, this life is, as the old hymn writers would have called it, a veil of tears. There is a sense in which there's something truly tragic to every moment of life. Oswald Chambers put it most brilliantly when he said, the Christian life begins when you give up the assumption that life is predictable and face that it is essentially tragic. Well, is it predictable? Is it tragic? And with tragedy as the more core part of life, always with the uncertainty, will death occur today? Will divorce occur today? What in the world is going to happen today in your life or my life? Then either one does one of two things. One entrenches, that is, somehow gets even harder and more convicted about living my own life under my own control, or one gets convicted in terms of God's goodness and allured to trusting him even more deeply. And what we're trying to say in The Cry of the Soul is that you will never learn to trust him until you've learned to fight him. Hmm. And the Psalms are the basis of learning to fight him with the emotions that exist within you. Not so much to resolve the emotions, but in facing them, to fight with him. And then in fighting with him, it does open the door to the potential of very, very significant surrender.
Hmm. In later re-releases of Dan Allender's book, Cry of the Soul, Johnny Erickson Tata is an endorser, talking about benefiting greatly from understanding through Allender's writing about what her emotions said, much more about her relationship with God than her earthly human relationships. We visited with Johnny Erickson Tata on more than one occasion, including on June 8th, 1995.
We've been carrying Johnny and Friends for a number of years here on WWIB.
And I am so grateful for that. You know, I'm so grateful that we receive letters from listening friends in the Wisconsin area. It means that people are tuning in, especially people with disabilities, and mm-hmm. that means a lot to me.
We did a show back on the National Day of Prayer on the 4th of May, and I know you were in the Midwest then. You were in Chicago, weren't you, for that?
Right. I was in Chicago for the National Day of Prayer, and wasn't that a marvelous event? You know, we've mm-hmm. received so many comments from people who tuned in over networks all around the country. And just think, I mean, just a concert of prayer that united hundreds of thousands of Christians together in intercession and praise. Boy, I tell you, that was a wonderful time to be together, and I'm glad that so many people who listen over WWIB were listening and tuning in.
Well, again, we weren't able to have that particular broadcast on, but what I was going to say was that day we did have somebody in studio who had been paralyzed as a result of an accident. Miraculously, he has lived. But that, along the whole lines of living handicapped, and just briefly before we start to go to some phone calls, because I know there are a lot of people in the listening area that want to talk with you and express their appreciation to your ministry. What about that in terms of just the personal experience that you've gone through all these years as you look back on everything and the way that God has changed you? And also, living handicapped in America today, how are we becoming more accessible as we ought to?
Well, boy, these are good questions, especially right now that on our hearts and on our minds is the story of Christopher Reeve, who's back in Virginia having suffered that spinal cord injury as a result of that horseback riding accident. That's really been in the news, huh?
It sure has, yeah.
And we've been receiving lots of calls. And, you know, as I think about someone like Christopher and what he may be facing over the next months, and who knows, perhaps even a year, maybe even a lifetime. We don't know at this point how permanently his spinal cord injury is. But it's depressing. It's tough. It's hard. And I know that over 8,000 people every year suffer spinal cord injury as a result of, well, everything from diving accidents, automobile, horseback riding accidents like Mr. Reed. And it can be pretty tough to face a lifetime, an entire lifetime of total paralysis. And in this country today, I think there's, there's two ways of looking at it. Number one, we've got so much more access. We've got curb cuts. We've got increased job opportunities. We've got churches which are much more aware, and that's good. Many more people with disabilities out and about in the mainstream of life. But on the other hand, we have people like Kevorkian, who has assisted in suicide over 23 people with disabilities. Most of them were not in terminal stages. They just had chronic conditions, much like me. And so it's hard to say. I mean, it so much depends on your family, your friends, your neighbors, the community, the support system you have. But if you're alone out there by yourself struggling to make ends meet spiritually and emotionally, you could end up in suicidal despair and be preyed upon like someone of a Kevorkian type. And that's kind of disconcerting. I think that sends out an alarm to all of us in the Christian church to be on the lookout of how we can help friends like these.
Almost 10 years to the day before Front Page went on the air on WWIB, contemporary Christian recording artist Keith Green and two of his children died in a plane crash July 28, 1982. 18 years later, August 7th of 2000, we talked with his widow, Melody Green.
Melody Green, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mark. It's great to be here.
Good to have you on today, and we're going to touch on not only the book, No Compromise, the life story of Keith Green, which has been a bestseller, and I believe you've updated that too, right?
Yes, It came out a few months ago, and it begins and ends in the same place, mm-hmm. but in the middle, I told more stories and added more details to some of the stories that were in the first book.
And also, what is new as well is the devotional, If You Love the Lord, Uncompromising Devotions from the Heart of Keith Green.
That's really exciting because I just heard that that's on the top 20 best-selling list. And, they're all from Keith's teachings or his journals. And they're just short devotionals, like 2-3 pages where you could sit down and read the whole book or read one a day. And they're really good words from him.
Melody, when I say 18 years since that, does it seem like 18 years?
No, it doesn't. In fact, it was just 18 years. We just had the 18th mm-hmm. anniversary last week. And
Let me just personally say, I know we threw it out there, and we've been working to try to get you here for a couple of months, so great to have you.
Thank you.
We threw it out to try to have you July 28th, and that didn't work, and I understand, at least secondhand, that's kind of a day where you just as soon not be doing interviews.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those days that I sort of mark, you know, in my heart. And, it doesn't seem like 18 years. I mean, in some ways it seems like a long time, and in other ways it seems like just yesterday because it's so vivid. And mm-hmm. with Keith and two of my children dying, that's something that you're just indelibly marked by it.
September 26, 1997, a week after the untimely death of contemporary Christian recording artist Rich Mullins, we paid tribute here on Front Page.
Christian author Brennan Manning calls Mullins one of the finest friends he's ever had. Amidst the grieving, he says, we can also rejoice for Rich.
Rich Mullins is now an Easter man. That Hallelujah is a song. That he's passed over from death to life. And, I led Rich on a 3-day retreat this past February down in a resort above Atlanta. Just the two of us, a 3-day spiritual journey. And what struck him more than anything is how he lives everything he believes. I think the most appropriate epitaph on his tombstone would be Rich Mullins, a witness to Jesus Christ.
It's about as useless as a screen door on a submarine. Fade without words, baby. It just ain't happening. One is your left hand, one is your right. It'll take two strong arms to hold on tight. Some folks have cut off their nose just to spite their face. I think you need some words to show. For your alleged faith, well, there's a difference, you know, between having faith and playing make-believe. One will make you grow,
The other one just make you sleep. Talk about it. Gotta really think you oughta take a leap off of the ship before you claim to walk on water. Play without words like a song you can't sing. It's about as useless as a screen door on a submarine.
Renee Couture of Eau Claire recalls the first time she had a chance to meet Rich Mullen several years ago.
We were in Eastern Europe, both traveling for the summer, ministering, and just seeing what God was doing in Eastern Europe. And a ministry that I had been working with at the time was bringing him in for a little while, and I was one that picked him up at the train station and with him and Beaker. And then after that, I just spent the next several days just sharing our hearts together. It was someplace outside of Budapest, Hungary. Anybody that has been around me for more than a little bit knows that I thought he was one of the coolest people that I'd ever met anywhere in the world. And he just, something that I'm sure everybody says, talks about his honesty. And I told him, I said, Rich, you're the most raw man I've ever known in my entire life. And raw in the sense that he didn't hide anything. There was no pretense. He just was so honest. You know, he when I said he didn't hide anything, he didn't have everything all together, but who of us does? But he just was himself and talked about Jesus, and I knew that he loved God. And to me, that summer, I mean, it totally changed my life, because he challenged me about the love of God, challenged me that God totally, passionately loves me and is pursuing me. And I think probably more than anybody that I know knew, he just loved God and he acted like Jesus.
When he rolls up his sleeves, he ain't just putting on the Ritz.
Our God is an awesome God.
There's thunder in his footsteps and lightning in his fists.
Our God is an awesome God.
And the Lord wasn't joking when he kicked him out of Eden. It wasn't for no reason that he shed his blood. His return is very close, and so you better be believing that our God is an awesome God.
Our God is an awesome God.
Before God, I wasn't asking God why, in the sense of an angry, like, why, how could you let this happen? What's going on? But I was just like, God, why him? And I felt like really that God showed me these two verses out of Isaiah 57 that it says in verse 1 and 2, the righteous perish and no one ponders it in his heart. Devout men are taken away and no one understands that the righteous are taken away to be spared from evil. Those who walk uprightly enter into peace. They find rest as they lie in death. And I thought, okay, God, okay. You know, he's with you. He doesn't have any more questions. He doesn't have any more, you know, aching thoughts in his heart. And he's whole, and he's with you. And tell him that we love him and we'll miss him. And we look forward to sharing forever with you and him.
Our own Pat Dodds had the opportunity to meet and interview Rich Mullins on a couple of different occasions, and she recalls the impact he made.
5 years ago, Rich had a kind of boyish charm along with his boyish grin and boyish sense of humor. He just had a way of saying things that would shock you so you'd really remember what he was saying. I remember him saying that performing was like walking on stage with his pants down. You know that he was just expressing that he felt transparent and vulnerable, but the way he said it sure made you remember. What I liked about Rich is the fact that he didn't understand the Christian music industry or the celebrity status placed on musicians. He called himself just a guy who loves God and writes songs. What's the big deal? He never understood why some of his counterparts and colleagues needed posh hotels or bottled avian water in their contracts. He was kind of a give-me-a-bed, stage-and-sandwich kind of guy. And he enjoyed life. One of my favorite stories was about a 66 Chevy truck that he bought from a friend for $300 simply because his friend needed the money, and he happened to have $300. Everyone was telling him to get rid of that truck because it was going to break down on him any day, but he loved that truck. He moved from Nashville to Wichita in that truck, and it was still going. He said it had no air conditioning and just smelled of sweat. It didn't have a radio, and then he recanted and said, yes, it did have a radio, but it didn't work. But it didn't matter anyway, because when he and his longtime friend and co-songwriter Beaker traveled, they had a code of silence. I didn't need to ask why. If you know Rich's music, I know he and Beaker were praising God for his beautiful creation along the highway and were enjoying sweet communion with him. I'm so glad I had the joy of meeting and getting to know Rich Mullins. He always left you with something to think about. He's already missed.
But sometimes my life just don't make sense at all. When the mountains look so big, and my faith just seems so small. So hold me, Jesus, 'cause I'm shaking like a leaf. You have been king of my glory. Won't you be my prince of peace?
Renee Couture recalls the last time she had the chance to talk with Rich was last summer in Wisconsin.
I hadn't seen him in a long time, and I thought, man, he knows, you know, literally thousands upon thousands of people. And but I waited to talk to him, and he totally remembered me, and he's like, hey, what are you doing here? What's going on? And we were able to talk and kind of clear the air about some things that had happened, you know, in years back. And his attitude was like it always had been, you know, just right before God. And we had both kind of been misused, I guess, by a ministry. And but, you know, it's like we were both, you know, we forgave people. And he didn't have any bitterness towards this ministry. And it was just cool to clear the air and just have everything be at peace once again. And, you know, we laughed, and he had told me about Brennan Manning's book. He's like, have you ever read The Ragamuffin Gospel? And I said, no. And actually, we talked, you know, when we had been in Eastern Europe, we had talked about some of the stuff that now I read is in that book, and, you know, just about the love of God. Once again, you know, that message, even though we're around so many Christians, that modern-day Christianity, we forget about, we forget to talk about the love of God. And yet that should be the supreme focus in our lives and in our message that we bring to a lost world.
And finally, as we conclude our remembrance of Rich Mullins, Brennan Manning recalls the first time he and Rich met.
Yeah, we first met in Wichita, Kansas. Rich was finishing up his undergraduate degree at Friends University, and I was out there to speak, and he invited me out the next day for a lunch that lasted 4 hours, and I was struck by his ruthless honesty, the utter candor about the brokenness of his own life, and yet his absolute conviction in the unconditional love of God, loving him just as he is and not as he should be. And
is that where you two found a great agreement in that area? Because I know you're very honest as well.
Yeah, that's where our friendship, we broke through kind of all the admiration and trivial talk and really connected. Then later, he invited me up to New England, and I went on tour with him and the Ragamuffin Band, which he named after my book, The Ragamuffin Gospel. As you know, he wrote the introduction to that. And since then, we've managed to meet about two times a year. And last year at the in Nashville, there were Reunion Records had a 10th anniversary celebration for him that about 500 people attended, and I was asked to speak at that. And that was a great honor. And then this past April, I led a retreat in about 40 miles outside of Wichita for Rich. And this wasn't the Ragamuffin Band this time. It was another band that he was going on tour with. In fact, it was the, it was on this tour that he was killed. So I have nothing but wonderful memories of our friendship. And, you know, it's one of those guys that you can just come to trust, absolutely, because he was never on stage. Whether in his personal life or professional life, he was always just totally himself. I think he really lived out his identity as a disciple of Jesus and as Abba's child. So, it is really with honor that I call Rich Mullins my friend.
From time to time over the years on Front Page, we took the opportunity to talk with individuals about how they came to the saving faith in Jesus Christ. One such occasion was April 30th, 1999, when we talked with Terry Moulton about how he became a born-again Christian. This is even before Moulton entered the arena of politics.
The promise was, God, you can use me whatever way you want. I'll give it all back to you if I can just, you know,
make my living,
you know, in this passion, this thing that I love the most. So it was almost a year to the day that...
You get emotional about this.
That, almost a year to the day, Roger Audhart from WWIB started calling on me, you know, to sell me advertising on this Christian radio station. And I said, Roger, you know, he would come all the time. He's a pest. Bless his heart. But he would come to sell me advertising, and I'd say, Roger, man, I don't know, you know, Christian radio, every time I'd hear it, I'd zip by it on the dial, you know, just as fast as I could. I'd say, you know, Roger, why don't you get yourself a program, you know, like Al Linder or you know, like Dave Carlson does something like this, something that I know that there's some outdoorsmen listening for, you know. Then I might be interested, you know. Then I know there's some outdoors guys listening. So Roger, he come back and he said, Terry, how would you like to do your own show? You know, and man, he had me. You know, what could I say? I mean, my ego, I think, got in the way. Gee, that'd be kind of neat to do an outdoor show, you know. So I said, okay, Roger, good. I think that'd be great. I'll do it. Well, that was 12 years ago, and, you know, we're still doing it. Okay, now I'm on this Christian radio station, right? So now I got to listen, you know, to what's going on. And now God started pulling at me. The Holy Spirit started pulling at me, and this took a long time. It took 3-4 years, which we'll discover here, but things started to happen in my life. Not long after I started on the radio program, I was having a problem with insurance, and I went to my insurance agent's office, and I was working on this little problem, and as I left his office, he had heard me on the radio that morning. It was on Friday. And as I left his office, he looked at me and he said, Terry, I heard you on the radio this morning. He says, are you a Christian? Wow, are you a Christian? It was like somebody took a great big 2x4, a railroad tie, and hit me right across right in my stomach, you know. What did he mean? Are you a Christian? Don't I look like a Christian? You know, and I always thought of myself, you know, as being a Christian. But I wasn't, you know, and you know, I knew there was a God and everything else. And I remember getting in my truck and driving down the road, and I was mad at him for asking me that. Hmm. Why did he ask me that? Well, are you a Christian? And that question just kept going over and over and over in my mind. What, you know? And I remember I answered something stupid like, yeah, I think so, or something. You know, I mean, it was kind of nutty. But then one night, I was listening to the radio, coming home from closing the store, and it was actually a fishing opener. And Pete Dake was interviewing Al Lindner. Now, Al Lindner was my idol. You know, he founded Lindy Little Joe Tackle, and boy, he did all. I went to all his seminars that I could, and I read all his magazine articles. I'd tear them out and keep a file of them. You know, Al Lindner was, you know, he was a great fisherman. And I even named my tackle business because of Al Lindner. See, Lindner was Lindy Little Joe. That was his tackle business that he founded. So I figured Terry Moulton could be Moldy, you know. That was the stupidest thing I ever did, you know. Moldy tackle, you know, everybody laughs. In fact, you know, people still laugh. Some guy will say, you know, what do you got in your tackle box? Oh, a bunch of moldy tackle, you know, and it draws a laugh. It is really a dumb name. But see, Al Lindner was my idol, and I thought if he could be, you know, Lindner, Lindy, Moulton could be Moldy. You know, and some people used to call me Moldy. It was kind of a nickname. Well, Moldy is a dumb name to put on a business, you know. But I did it, and I can't change it now because it's been going on for 20 years. But anyway, I was listening to this interview, and Al Lindner was talking about Jesus Christ and about how he had accepted Christ into his life and how this had changed him.
You must have had to stop the truck.
I did, but you know, I stopped it as I'm going in my garage. I put up the garage door, and I'm driving into my garage, and he starts talking about Jesus, and I thought, man, what is going on here? You know, this is Al Lindner, this macho fisherman idol of mine. And he's talking about Jesus, and I remember listening to it, and I was just mesmerized again by this. I thought, what's going on here? There's got to be an angle or, you know, something. And I left the truck running and everything. And I remember my wife opening the garage door every so often, you know, looking out, wondering, you know, am I trying to kill myself here or what? In the garage, the vehicle's running, and finally I shut the vehicle off and listened to the rest of the interview. But the thing that touched me the most about that interview was Al told about how he had taken his kids out of the public school and put them in a Christian school, and neither him and his wife were Christians at that time, and they thought the Christian school, they didn't really even know it was a Christian school, they just knew it was a private school, and they wanted, you know, to put their kids there, and all of a sudden his wife started going, and pretty soon his wife was going to church regularly, and his wife came home one day and she said, honey, I asked Jesus to come into my heart today, and Al said he looked at her, and she looked the same, and he said he grabbed her, and he felt the same, you know, that she felt the same. He said, well, that, you know, that's good for you and the kids, and, you know, it's probably good, but it's no great shakes for me, you know. And Al said over the next 2 years, the family would pray at meals, and especially at night. And his wife, they would go up with his two boys, and his wife would pray, and the two boys would pray, but Al would never pray. Al didn't know how to pray. And finally one night, the little boy, his little five-year-old, he said, Daddy, you know, can you come in and put me to bed, you know? And he said, Daddy, and the thing was, his mom had always told the kids, Daddy prays by himself alone when we're not, you know, when we're not around, or when we're at church, Daddy prays by himself.
Hmm.
Well, the little five-year-old asked him, his dad, Al, to tuck him in. And he said, Daddy, can you pray for me now like you pray when you're alone? And maybe it was, and Al said, you know, it was just like a sudden jolt, like somebody had whacked him across the forehead. He said, I didn't know how to pray. You know, I didn't know how to pray. The words couldn't even come out of my mouth. And maybe I put myself into that same position at that exact time, and I thought of my own children and how I had not been the spiritual leader to them in my family. But there was something about that. And then Al knew right then and there that something, you know, was wrong. And he remembered, like, about 2 days later, the preacher from the church came calling at the door. And Al says, I knew in my heart. He said, I knew what he was there for, and he said, I got down on my knees, you know, that day, and I asked Jesus to be Lord and Savior of my life. And again, I thought, man, Al Lindner, and he's talking to him this way, you know, what's going on? And I went, I came to the station, and I got a copy of that interview of that Pete made, and I would play it over and over and over again. And, and you know, trying to figure out, you know, there had to be something here that I, you know, that I was missing, you know. And God kept doing all sorts of things like that. And the other thing that really grabbed me one time was I was going to the bank, and in my first store was downtown Chippewa, and it was on the second floor of a building, and there was an alley alongside, and there was dumpsters out there, and there used to be an elderly man that I called a bum. He was very poor, but he would always be rummaging through the garbage to get cans, aluminum cans, and then take them to be recycled and collect some money for it. And I always avoided him because, you know, he was very dirty. And so every time I'd go down the alley, I'd go as far to one side as I possibly could. One day I'm coming back from the bank, and he's in the garbage dumpster. I can see it just like it's right now. And he's buried right up in there to the waist, and he's throwing stuff out, and there's cans flying, and dust and dirt coming out of there. And he pops his head up out of that garbage dumpster, and on his head he has a hat, and it says Moldy's Hog Wobbler on it. You could just barely see the print. It was so dirty. And again, it was just like God hit me in the stomach with a big board. I mean, this dirty old man with my cap on, I thought, you know, I'd love to have Al Linder wearing my cap, but not this guy, you know. And for some reason, I don't know if it went back to my Sunday school days, I just immediately thought of the Bible verse where Jesus said, when you do this unto the least of my brethren, you do it under me. I think it's Matthew 25:40. But that hit me all of a sudden. And I went up and I got some cans, and I saved cans for the guy for a while, and we gave him gloves at Christmas time and so forth. But it was just a number of those things that started happening. And they weren't coincidences, mm-hmm. you know, that I later found out. But finally...
Well, I was just going to say one other thing. I know along the way I've heard you say, and I think it's interesting and humorous, that you had thought when you'd come on this radio station, WWIB, with your program, you thought, well, who really listens? Are anybody going to hear me? Yeah. And you were overwhelmed by how many people. And I remember you telling me for quite a while, wherever you'd go, you kept hearing new people all the times, and you didn't know these people listen to Christian radio.
Right, right. You know, I was always amazed. I'd go to Rhineland, or I'd go to Park Falls, or I'd go somewhere, you know, way out of the way, a long ways away, and somebody come up to me and say, "Hey, I listened to you. I listened to you on Friday mornings." You know, I was like, "Wow!" You know, that was mm-hmm. really unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, what happened was, okay, I got this business that I dreamed about. I got everything that you could possibly want, and somehow it still wasn't, you know, it just didn't seem to fill up something that I was missing. And I decided I was going to sell the business. I'd only been in it about 2 or 3 years, and we were going to list it for sale. And I drew up ads, and I was going to run them in some of the big city papers and so forth. And I was coming to the radio station one day, and I saw a sign on the building across the way here. It said for lease, and it was a beautiful building, Nelson Sports Center's old building. And I went home to my wife, and I said, man, would that be a great location for a business like ours? But, nah, forget it. It's way out of our league, you know. Well, I went, and Pete Dake said, well, why don't you go over and talk to Mr. Nelson? We did, and one thing led to another. He was interested in me, and I was interested in the location, and it fell into place, and it happened to be Good Friday. That we were going to sign the papers on this deal. And I remember driving out here and driving over to his business, and I remember praying and saying, God, if this is really what you want me to do, please give me some kind of sign. And I walked into his place of business, a man sitting there at the desk. I didn't know him from Adam. His name was Scott, and he said, you're Terry Moulton, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I listen to you every Friday morning on the radio, you know. To me, that was my sign anyway, but
that'll do.
I signed away my life, then I signed a contract, and we started a business out here. But that was on Good Friday. I came back to the store. My wife was there. We looked at each other. She had been listening to the radio, listening to it was Good Friday, listening to Evie mm-hmm. Hill, the black preacher, and another preacher talking about how they really revved up the congregation. And he said, "All I said, it's Friday, but Sunday's a coming." Talking about, you know, Jesus' resurrection and stuff. And we both grabbed each other, and we hugged, and we cried. And, And I said, you know, it's time that I made a change in my life. And I called the radio station. It was Good Friday. It was 1991. And I said, you guys had devotional times then on Monday mornings. Mm-hmm. I said, I'd like to come in Monday morning and speak. Mm-hmm. And I came in Monday morning. Monday morning, 91 was the first of April, April Fool's Day.
Hmm.
And I think some of the staff thought I was coming in. I'm kind of a prankster anyway. And some of the guys thought I was probably coming in with an April Fool's joke. But I came in that Monday morning, April Fool's Day. I was 44 years old. I've been a fool almost all my life. And I gave my heart to the Lord on that morning. I think, I don't remember exactly but I what I thought, but I knew something had changed in me. I knew that that I was on a new road. You know, I was on a new road, and you know, he's taken me down all kinds of different paths since then. But and it hasn't been, you know, I didn't suddenly, everything wasn't rosy, you know, right away, or still isn't, you know, perfect. But
you talked about off the air. You told me how the WWIB staff didn't hit you over the head with the Bible. Roger Adorf established that initial contact, and things developed over time.
Yeah, it didn't happen just suddenly. It was like about a 3-year process there. But the thing that always impressed me about the staff here at WWIB is they didn't whack me over the head with the Bible. They didn't, you know, try and beat things into me. They just plain loved me to Christ, and you know, the love of Jesus Christ was in them, and it eventually absorbed into my thick skull.
A best of Front Page celebrating 24 years on the air here on WWIB and WIB.com. Thanks for listening. The preceding made possible thanks to you and your generous tax-deductible support of Western Wisconsin's Inspirational Broadcaster Incorporated. Check out our July gift offers, including Stephen Curtis Chapman's Worship and Believe online at WWIB.com.